From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Spector of the New York Times about covering the war in Chechnya. Last month, the Russian army was defeated by Chechen rebels who want Chechnya to break away from the Russian Federation. Spector was last in Chechnya as the war was ending. He's interviewed rebel leaders, Russian soldiers, and the Russian National Security Advisor, Alexander Lebed, who negotiated the peace agreement with the separatists. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir, Angela's Ashes, by Frank McCourt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Kurva Coleman. CIA Director John Deutsch says Iraqi tanks are pulling back from the Erbil area of northern Iraq. NPR's Paul Miller reports.
CIA Director Deutsch told the Senate Intelligence Committee Iraq's tanks and motorized units are withdrawing from Erbil and northern Kurdish areas. That contradicted a report from the Kurdish faction known as the PUK that Iraqi armored units had attacked it again. An earlier Iraqi attack on PUK forces led to United States cruise missile strikes against Iraqi air defense positions and the creation of an expanded no-fly zone in the south of the country. United Nations observers say the PUK is involved in fighting today with another Kurdish faction, the KDP. PUK leader Jalal Talabani said he will ask for help from Iran in his fight against the KDP and their Iraqi allies. I'm Paul Miller in Washington.
Hurricane Fran is bearing down on the Carolinas. The South Carolina coast is beginning to get tropical storm force winds. The National Hurricane Center also reports rain squalls on shore as the edge of the big storm moves in. Fran is likely to make landfall between Georgetown and Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, but forecasters warn Fran has picked up speed and could strike earlier than expected. Fran has sustained winds of 115 miles per hour. Officials warn those could go up to 130 miles per hour. Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole has let his top media team go, citing an organizational dispute. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Dayton.
Tonight, the Dole campaign unveils a five-minute ad, the product of a creative team that's no longer with the campaign. Don Sippel and Mike Murphy, the partnership that's done all of Dole's media for months, including the promotional video at the convention, have left the campaign. They part as friends, according to campaign spokesman Nelson Warfield, in an attempt to downplay the move. Warfield said the two left because they were not comfortable accepting a greater level of supervision by the campaign's chief strategist, Scott Reed. But Sippel had moved away from a central role in the campaign months ago by his own choice. Dole will now rely on media consultant Alex Castellanos and others for his ads in the future. The shakeup comes as Dole tries to close a yawning gap in the polls. Months ago, Dole parted ways with his chief pollster and campaign manager after placing second in the New Hampshire primary. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Dayton.
Russian news reports say President Boris Yeltsin will have heart surgery at the end of the month. The reports say Yeltsin made the announcement during a Russian television interview. He reportedly says medical tests showed that he has heart disease and that he had two options, an operation or a less stressful daily routine. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 5.5 points in light trading. The Nasdaq is also down 5 points at 1,138. This is NPR. A Federal Express cargo plane made an emergency landing this morning in Newburgh, New York. It erupted into flames just after landing. The three-member crew escaped. The DC-10 was on its way from Memphis to Boston, but it was diverted to Stewart International Airport in Newburgh after the crew reported smoke in the cockpit. The plane landed about dawn. The fire quickly spread into the cockpit and then through the rest of the plane. Flames shot through the jet's fuselage before firefighters put out the blaze. No injuries were reported. The father of tennis star Steffi Graf is on trial today in Mannheim, Germany, on charges of tax evasion. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
The lucrative tennis career, the number one female player, is managed by Peter Graf. German prosecutors claim he consistently underreported profits his daughter earned from tournaments and advertising contracts. Much of the money paid by clients went into accounts in the Netherlands and the Caribbean. Graf disputes this money is taxable by German tax authorities. He recently paid more than $13 million in back taxes, but is fighting to get the money returned. The family's tax accountant, Joachim Eckhart, is charged with complicity in the alleged tax evasion scheme. Both Graf and accountant Eckhart have been kept in jail since their arrest a year ago to prevent a flight across the border. The trial will last at least 4 months. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The Census Bureau reports that last year, black Americans completed their high school education at about the same rate as white Americans did. The rate for black Americans in their late 20s was 87%, about the same level as white Americans. The percentage of all adults 25 and older who have finished high school reached 82%. That's the highest it's been since it was first measured 50 years ago. Also, the Census Bureau reports the proportion of adults who've earned a bachelor's degree set a new record, 23% last year. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Spector, witnessed the results of the staggering defeat of the Russian army in Chechnya last month. The Russian army, the largest in Europe, was driven out by Chechen rebels who want the republic to break away from the Russian Federation. The war, which began in late 1994, has taken an enormous toll on Chechnya and Russia. Russia estimates 80,000 people died, Grozny is virtually destroyed, and Russia is humiliated. A peace agreement is now in effect, arranged by Russian National Security Advisor Alexander Lebed and separatist leaders. But the issue the war was fought over, Chechen independence, remains unresolved. Earlier today, we called Michael Spector in Moscow to discuss the war and his experiences covering it. He's the New York Times co-bureau chief in Moscow. His last trip to Grozny was in mid-August as the offensive was winding down and it was clear the rebels had won the battle. He told me how he got in.
I eventually walked in. I walked in with two British journalists. There's a road through a region of Grozny called Chernoretsky that tens of thousands of refugees were using to flee and that the rebels were using to enter the city. And the Russian Air Force at that point was bombing a bit, not as much as they had been, and the helicopters were up and firing. And this road was somewhat covered by trees and a little more protected than other routes. And it was just the route that people used to go in. So we just got a ride to the edge of the city and walked.
What did this city look like when you got there?
Well, Grozny has been a tremendous symbol of utter devastation since January 1995 when the Russian Air Force essentially totally destroyed it. And it is hard to imagine in the post-World War II era anything looking more devastated and ruined than Grozny already looked. However, over the last year, it had come a little bit crawling back to life. There was water, there was electricity, some buildings had been renovated, especially the government buildings that Russians worked on to prove that they were in control. And by the time we got back in there, all those buildings were in just shards again. Some were on flame. Gas flames were burning everywhere. There was no water. The few buildings on every block that weren't destroyed were often destroyed again. The train station that had been renovated at great cost as a sort of Potemkin show that the Russians were in control had been utterly wasted by the rebel onslaught. The city was completely dead.
Did you have food with you?
Not really. I had, things like power bars with me and some water. We had intended, and in fact, we decided not to stay overnight. I mean, you never know what's going to happen, and you might end up being forced to stay overnight, but we had intended to go in for the day and each day, and that's sort of what we did at the beginning. And in fact, because it's summertime here and the days are long, it's not a big problem. It's more of a problem doing something that in the winter when it gets dark at 4.
Michael, what was your plan about where to look to find the stories that you wanted to cover in Grozny the city fell?
The story is very easy to find in a war zone often. I mean, the things that are difficult is staying safe, hearing enough of the story so you get a sense of what happened, and just sort of the rudimentary facts of sending your stuff to New York. But in terms of finding the story, you walk up to a bunch of rebels and you talk to them, and you essentially say, take me to your leader. They usually do. So after, you know, after a half an hour, we were talking to a guy named Ahmad Zakayev, who's one of the major rebel leaders and actually had the title of National Security Advisor in the separatist government, and a guy that I had run into before. And he talked to us for a while and basically decided we were okay and said, you know, go on into the center of town, help yourself. When we did that, what we saw were that the entire town was controlled by the rebels. Kids, and I mean kids, were driving up and down in stolen cars with green flags of the separatist government of Ishkiria, which is what the Chechens would call their country if it was a country. And there were no Russians to be found at all except those who were prisoners or surrounded.
What about those who were dead? Were there a lot of bodies in the street that were left there?
There were still some bodies in the street, but they were sort of clustered in certain places, like around the main government building. A couple days before, a lot of them had been cleared away, but there were still bodies in the street, and in fact, there were bodies in the street for several days afterwards until a firmer ceasefire was agreed upon, and the rebels let the Russians come collect their dead.
When the city fell, was there any sense of victory in the air or just of death? I mean, you have to wonder how much victory there is when what you're winning is a city that's totally destroyed.
I don't think that that's the way the Chechen fighters looked at it. I mean, first of all, the city has been totally destroyed for almost 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and it was destroyed by the Russian Air Force, and it was destroyed by the Russian artillery assault in January of 95. And I think really, basically, this is a fight that's gone on in one form or another for almost 300 years, and Chechen separatists just don't believe that they are or should be a part of Russia. And so, yeah, I mean, their entire land, which is about the size of Connecticut or larger, is devastated in a way that is very difficult to describe. At least it's difficult for me to describe. It's almost impossible to find a village that isn't shattered. But it's theirs, you know, they want it. And so they're happy. They were very happy. They were jubilant. I mean, they're, as we talk today on Thursday morning, and tomorrow is the official Independence Day of Chechnya. It's the anniversary of the day they declared themselves to be independent. And this is what this war was about. And so we will see what happens on Friday. It's a very tricky political issue because basically the Russians have gotten a promise from the Chechen leaders that they won't turn this into a big parade so that there can be a fig leaf about the fact that Chechnya is still a part of Russia. And I think that's going to be very hard for a lot of people who have fought for 2 years and who have had many, many friends and family members died to do.
You spoke to rebel leaders and to fighters. What did you learn about why independence from Russia means so much to the separatists?
Well, you know, it's funny. When the war started in December 1994, I actually don't think that most people in Chechnya supported the separatist leader, the late Dzhokhar Dudayev, and I don't believe they necessarily cared that much about independence. But as they saw the Russian army roil through their land, destroy their villages, kill their family members, they became more and more indignant and more convinced that they didn't want to be a part of that country. So I think there's a feeling there now that Chechnya is its own place, that it has traditions that have nothing to do with Russia, that Russia's desire for Chechnya to be a part of the Russian Federation are really desires to stem the loss that has come with it, with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. They're psychological needs rather than and economic ones, rather than a real feeling that Chechnya is a part of Russia. The Chechens are different types of people. They're not Slavic. They're often treated very badly, particularly in Moscow, but in other cities. And there's a very radical difference between a Chechen and a typical Slavic Russian.
What are some of the differences?
They're Muslim. Russians are not, as a rule, Muslim. They're Orthodox. Their people from a land that's sort of somewhere between the Middle East and Asia and the West and the East, and they don't see the world the way the Russians see the world. The Russians have wanted to have a great empire for a long time. They had one and they lost it, and it's very difficult for them. They had to give up many, many places that were separate republics. They didn't have to give up Chechnya, and they sure as hell don't want to give it up now. And so far they have succeeded, because actually Chechnya is not becoming a separate country right now.
Why would Russia think Chechnya is worth sacrificing so much for it to hold on to? I mean, what's left of it now that would be of benefit to Russia?
Well, it has nothing. I mean, first of all, there's tremendously valuable oil in the region, and the pipelines go through Chechnya. That's sort of one of the significant facts of life here. Oil is important. It's money. It's power. Beyond that, I think if the Mexican part of Southern California decided that it didn't want to be a part of the United States, that would be a problem for the United States. This is just an issue of sovereignty and of Russia saying, we lost our great empire, but we're not, maybe if Chechnya goes, then Tatarstan will go, and Siberia will go, and Vladivostok will go. And I don't actually think there's any real danger of any of that, but there was a few years ago, and I think some politicians here still believe it, and other ones use it as a reason to be tough.
Getting back to the Chechen separatists, what are some of the historical reasons that the Chechens are so fearful of Russians?
Well, Russians have spent a good couple hundred years going down there and killing them and taking their land and conquering them. Grozny in Russian means threatening or terrible, depending upon the way you look at it. And, it was set up as a Cossack fortress a long time ago. Many of the great poets of Russia, Lermontov, Pushkin, Tolstoy, have written at great length about the Caucasus and about the need to defeat the Caucasus and captivate the Caucasus. They have this sort of incredibly powerful romantic hold on the Russian soul. They're very beautiful, but also they're very freedom-loving, and it scares the hell out of Russians, and they don't like to think these people are going to just do what they want. It's just a way of saying, you are not powerful anymore. We can leave you, and you can't stop us. And that's just not very easy for a country that 10 years ago was one of the great superpowers on Earth.
It's kind of shocking that the Chechen separatists were able to defeat the Russian army. You spoke with the rebel leader, Shamil Basayev. Did he give you any insights into what the separatist military strategy was that enabled them to win?
Well, yeah. I mean, they do have a strategy. They just felt that they were capable of, they would come out at night, they would shoot at guard posts, they would kill a few Russians at a time, they would scare the hell out of the Russians. The Russians are very, very badly treated by their own army. They don't have enough food. They don't have proper clothing. They often go into battle without flak jackets. Their guns are in poor repair. It's a scandal. But more than that, many small countries have defeated large. The United States lost in Vietnam, and Russia lost in Afghanistan, and France lost in Algeria. And in the end, if you are totally dedicated to something, morally believe in your cause, and you're fighting a much bigger power that really doesn't want to do anything but serve its time and get the hell out of there, you're probably going to end up winning.
My guest is Michael Spector. He's the New York Times co-chief of the Moscow Bureau, and he's also been covering the war in Chechnya. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Spector, co-bureau chief in Moscow for the New York Times. He's also covered the war in Chechnya. Tell us something about Basayev. Who is he? Where did he come from?
He grew up in Chechnya. He went to school in Moscow. for a while, he wanted to sell computer parts. He wanted to be a lawyer, but he couldn't. He felt that he was discriminated against here. He's a great hero in Chechnya, but he's also a man who absolutely does not shirk from killing people. He showed up in Abkhazia and helped battle there on the side of the rebels against Georgia in the early 1990s. Wherever Caucasian separatists want to secede, he seems to be there. He pulled the most notorious stunt of this war last year by taking 100 of his men to a small southern town called Budyonovsk, seizing a hospital there, killing scores of people, and basically demanding that the war end or he would kill them all. Viktor Chernomyrdin, the prime minister of Russia, entered into what at the time were remarkable negotiations with this man, broadcast on television. We were able to see the prime minister of Russia chatting with a person who could be considered one of the great terrorists now alive. And in the end, the Russian army tried to storm the hospital twice, failed both times. Basayev and his men left with hostages. They got in buses. They went back to Chechnya, where they were greeted as great returning conquering heroes. And Basayev, to this day, is one of the major rebel commanders.
The hostages that he took and the people who he killed at the hospital, these were civilians?
Most of them were civilians. They let most of the hostages go as soon as they got to Chechnya.
Mm-hmm.
I think Basayev's view of the world is you've killed 30 or 40,000 or 60 or 70,000 Chechen civilians. I'm happy to kill a few hundred of yours when I need to. I mean, you know, it is true that he's not a man who thinks twice about killing a civilian. It is also true that probably 10 members of his own family have been killed in Russian bombing raids in the last year. So that sort of turns people bloodthirsty, though you could argue that he, in fact, was that way before this happened.
One of the things that he said to you was that Russian troops were left by their own leaders in 1995 on the streets of Grozny to be eaten by dogs. Was that hyperbole, or is that actually true?
It's absolutely true. We all saw it. It's absolutely true. In 1995, the Russians were sent in to take Grozny against the rebels. The Russians had no idea what Grozny looked like. Most of them didn't have maps in their tanks. A lot of them didn't have enough gas to get where they were going. They were taken out in incredible numbers on January 1st and 2nd. They were just lined up and killed. I mean, the tanks were just killed. One by one, the people in the tanks died. And then huge infantry battles broke out near the train station, near the administrative center. Scores of Russians died in those battles and were left to lie on the streets. Absolutely, it's absolutely not hyperbole. We all saw it.
What does the defeat of the Russians in Grozny say about the state of the Russian army now?
The state of the Russian army, the Russian army is a pathetically weak institution. They have nuclear weapons, and they have submarines. And nuclear weapons are scary, and I think that in the West, one would always take Russia seriously because they have a lot of them. But in terms of infantry, in terms of the ability to fight, they don't have it. They don't have the budget, they don't have the money, they don't have the training, they don't have the moral will to be the army they once were. Alexander Levitt, who's now the national security advisor in charge of resolving this war in Chechnya, who was spent his life in the military, is constantly talking about the pathetic, pitiful state of the Russian army, and it's obviously something that makes him deeply sick.
How did the Chechen separatist army get to be so good?
They train a lot. They trained in other places like Afghanistan. They get money from the Islamic world, and they stole a lot of weapons from the Russians. So in terms of having supplies, it's understandable. But in terms of being really good, they're very disciplined. And I believe that, again, has something a little bit to do with their nature as human beings. They're very devoted. They do not drink. They get their job done. They listen to their bosses. But I think the other thing is they want independence more than Russia wants Chechnya to be a part of the Russian Federation. And so they're very committed. And I think that's probably the main thing that makes them so good.
Were you able to talk with any of the Russian soldiers in Chechnya?
Yeah. You're always able to talk to them. It wasn't as easy this time because they weren't as evident this time because most of them were gone or in hiding or surrounded. But at checkpoints outside of Grozny where Russian soldiers were, it's easy to talk to them. They're happy to tell you what they think.
Well, what do they think? What kind of candid remarks did you hear about their feelings about being stationed in Chechnya?
I've never talked to a Russian soldier in 2 years that has said, this is a horrible war, but we have to fight it to protect the integrity of Russia. They all say, get me the hell out of here. My time is up soon. I'm here to serve. It's sort of like it was, I believe, in Vietnam for American soldiers. You know, they thought about their tour. They did not think about the victory of the American forces or the American way of life. They thought about making it from the beginning to the end of the tour, and that's what happens in Chechnya. They just want to get through alive and get out.
You wrote in one of your articles that if you ever had trouble getting through a checkpoint, you know, a loaf of bread would help you through, that the Russian soldiers were so desperate for food.
Oh, yeah, they have nothing. They get about $8 a month in salary, and they don't usually get that. When you travel around, you just need to bring cigarettes and food, and other people bring vodka. I don't, because I just feel they get enough vodka and I'm almost nervous enough about the fact that the entire Russian army is drunk after dark. But, you know, they're very grateful to take whatever you give them. And it's not really bribery. It's not like whipping out $100. I mean, giving a guy a loaf of bread is not the same sort of thing as buying your way into town.
Michael Spector spoke to us from Moscow, where he's co-bureau chief for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. We'll hear more from Spector in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Michael Spector of the New York Times about covering the war in Chechnya. Maureen Corrigan reviews Frank McCourt's memoir about growing up Irish Catholic in Ireland. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Michael Spector of the New York Times. He's co-chief of the Moscow Bureau. We called him earlier today to discuss his experiences covering the war in Chechnya and the new peace agreement. Last month, the Russian army was defeated in Grozny, the Chechen capital, by Chechen separatists who want to break away from the Russian Federation. Well, the fighting in Chechnya appears to have stopped. There is a truce that appears to still be in effect. Negotiations are going on. Lebed today is in Chechnya. What's on the table?
Well, a lot of things are on the table. I think Lebed today, this morning, he went to Chechnya, and I think the main thing he wants to ensure happens is that the military side of this peace agreement is carried out, and that means that prisoners are exchanged, that people stop shooting at each other, and it's still happening, though not very much, and that the commissions that they've set up operate, that there is at least some semblance of joint command of military districts. The bigger thing that's on the table is a political future for that region. And they have essentially... Go ahead.
No, I mean, it's not a done deal yet that Chechnya will get its independence, even though it won the war.
It's not only not a done deal, I don't think it'll happen, at least it won't happen soon, because this is the make-or-break thing for the Kremlin. They're not giving up Chechnya. They want to be able to say, Chechnya fought a war to secede from the Russian Federation, and they did not win. And Chechnya, at this point, just wants the soldiers out of Chechnya, and they're happy to say, hey, they sent the Russian army here, and we kicked them out. So what will probably happen is a sort of vague fugue state for a few years where Chechnya is a part of Russia and Russia doesn't dare go down there or bother with them. And Chechnya gets to control what it wants to control. But there are an awful lot of political problems associated with that, including the current government of Chechnya, which is a puppet government installed by Russia. Those people don't really probably have very long to live if they were to stay there right now.
Since the separatists want independence from Russia so badly, will they be willing, do you think, to settle for an agreement in which they don't actually get the independence? Because the agreement that's being looked at now is that in 5 years there'll be some decision, you know, about whether Chechnya actually gets its independence from Russia.
I think that it might work for a while. The country's so beaten up. So many millions, billions of dollars would be needed to rebuild it. And I don't see how Chechnya could hope to do that by itself. So I think they're basically telling each other and themselves, let's let Russia spend some money on us. Let's have our own sort of semi-autonomous world here where they don't mess with us. And let's call it our world for now. And then we'll get our independence later. We'll have a referendum. I think that, you know, even though they are very good and very committed, they've just been through a very bruising couple of years. And the truth is Russia could come in with, you know, more air power and more artillery and kill lots more people. And I think they're willing to do this for a while. You know, in the end, over 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, you know, I think that if Russia tries to reassert its control of Chechnya, this type of thing could happen again. I mean, you're right. The answer... The war started for something that was not decided by the war.
The Chechens are hoping that the Russians will help rebuild Chechnya. Russia doesn't have a lot of money right now, and my understanding is that Boris Yeltsin promised a lot of money to a lot of different constituencies in the hopes that those promises would help him win the election. So what do you think the chances are that Russia will actually be able to spend a significant amount of money on rebuilding Chechnya?
Well, Russia itself, I think they'll spend some money, but I think also there are economic interests. There are reasons why private people, why gas firms and oil firms would be willing to spend some money there. And so it doesn't just have to be Russia. It has to be people who feel in that very geographically central part of the world it's safe enough and secure enough an investment to spend money. And if people feel that way, they will spend some money, but it's not going to be, you know, don't look for 2 years for Chechnya to be rebuilt. It's going to be a really long time. really long.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Spector, and he's been covering Moscow and Chechnya for the New York Times. Yeltsin's national security advisor, Alexander Lebed, said from the start of the war that the war would end in disaster for Russia. Is he seen now in Russia as being something of a hero for being right about that, or is he disliked for being a doomsayer whose prediction actually came true?
Both. I think the average person here is very grateful to him for saying the truth. Lebed served in Afghanistan, and he saw what happened there, and he's a military man, and he's a sort of by-the-book, skeptical, cool assessor of a situation. He went down there. I think he realized it was hopeless. And rather than kill more Chechens and kill more Russians, he just was willing to say what no Russian leader had been willing to say, which is, we're not going to win here. The Chechens aren't just a bunch of bandits, but a very good fighting force. Let's stop it. There are a lot of people here who are very anxious about that because the communists, but not just the communists, Boris Yeltsin has not yet met with Mr. Lebed. To be seen as giving away something to a bunch of people that are always described in the Russian press as bandits is not particularly heroic. Lebed is a guy who's got the image of a nationalist hero. But nationalist heroes don't give away part of their territory to bands of people that nationalists consider thugs. So it's very complicated.
He wants to be the next president?
He says he does. He wanted to be the president this time around. He ran. He did surprisingly well. Got 14.5% of the vote, about 11 million voters. A lot of those people voting for him because of his stance against the war. And a lot of them are voting for him because he's sort of one of these guys who is pathologically committed to saying what's on his mind. And Yeltsin immediately signed him up as his junior partner after the first round of voting in a somewhat clever, possibly cynical move. It was good for Lebed, too, because now he's got more exposure and he works in the Kremlin and he can probably run and say, I've got experience.
You're writing an article now on Lebed for the New York Times Magazine. How much access have you had to him?
A reasonable amount. He's a fairly savvy guy about the press.
Mm-hmm.
He knows the press matters. He knows even that the foreign press matters. He knows that his reputation is as a somewhat brutish general, and he would like to try and change that.
My guest is Michael Spector, who's joining us on the phone from Moscow, where he's co-bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Spector, who has covered the war in Chechnya and the subsequent peace agreement for the New York Times. Michael Spector, was Chechnya the first time that you were in a war zone?
Yeah, it was the first time I was in a real war zone. I've been in places like Bombay during extremely horrible riots, but I've never been in a war zone before. I've been in places like Nagorno-Karabakh, which are war zones, but they're kind of junior league war zones compared to Chechnya.
Were there things that you saw or you experienced that you feel you could not have been mentally prepared for?
Yes. Did they mentally prepare anyone in my college or upbringing for watching people get killed, watching cities get destroyed? It's just, I don't know. I don't think humans are ever, I hope humans are never mentally prepared for this. It's bad. It's horrible. Watching planes come over the sky and drop bombs on you is really way beyond scary.
Were you surprised by any of your own reactions?
It's an interesting question. I don't know. I guess I was surprised that I was able to do it to some degree. I don't think I ever thought of myself as your basic war correspondent. But you are, I mean, it would also be dishonest to say that it wasn't compelling. To watch what people are capable of doing to each other, and to watch a city, you know, I was there when the bombing started in 1994, and to watch a city that was not an elegant Parisian city, but, you know, a little nicer than the average Soviet-built city, be totally destroyed is really something that I can't say I'm completely sorry that I saw this process, but I will be perfectly happy not to see it again.
How did you file?
well, we have fabulous technology. When it started, we would go to the Périgord point, which are these telephone booth places in the middle of Grozny before it got destroyed, and you'd wait in line. You'd call Moscow, and you'd scream your story to one of your colleagues in Moscow who would type it down, and they would send it for you. When they blew the Périgord point up, that became useless. Then we all started getting satellite telephones, which I now have, and basically it's about a 15-pound unit. It started out about 35 pounds a year and a half ago. They just keep getting better. And you sort of take a little dish and get out a compass like a Boy Scout, and you fix it on the nearest satellite. You plug it in, and you call New York or wherever in the world you want. And the one I have now also sends data. So basically I just whip out my satellite phone, plug in my computer, write my story, and then just press a button, and it's in New York a minute later.
Now, it must be a very odd feeling to be doing it when everything around you is, when there's no water, everything around you is
strange.
In flames.
I mean, I've sat in Grozny with a headlamp on my head in a place with no water, with no electricity, using a satellite telephone running off a car battery and having a normal conversation with people in New York who are about to go out to have sushi for lunch. It's definitely strange.
What's it like to be on the phone when you're there in a war zone, everything's in flames around you, and you're talking to the home office and everything's business as usual there?
Most of the guys I talk to in New York have been through things that I've been through, and a lot of them have been through more of it than me. And they're very very supportive and nice, and they don't sort of act like, kid, you're bothering me, I've got to go play tennis. So, you know, they're always very, I've never tired of saying how supportive they are when you're in a situation like this. But it is very incongruous. It's weird to be able to call your mom from Grozny. And on the day when she's sitting there reading in the New York Times how horrible and dying everyone is, you're just sort of chatting away saying, everything's fine, I'm home.
you know, considering that Russian soldiers at checkpoints are really grateful for a loaf of bread, I'm wondering if, you know, Russian or separatist fighters want your satellite phone, if people have tried to take that from
you. Oh, yeah, they all want to use them, and sometimes we let them use them.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm wondering if they want to keep them, if they want to steal them.
You know, there hasn't been too much theft of things like that that I know of in the last couple of years. I don't actually know of any instance where someone got their phone or computer stolen. I'm sure it's happened. I got a radio stolen once, but I mean, that's sort of minor. And it was by a guy who was really sort of pissed off more than thievy. I think these people sort of do respect your personal possessions. The main thing that happens is they all say, do you have a satellite phone? And they want to call their family, which we sometimes let them do if we have the time or if we need them. In the earlier days of the war, when you wanted to get by a checkpoint and you could promise someone they could call Moscow, it really helped. Sometimes they just write down their phone number on a piece of paper with a name and ask if you would call later for them.
You know, the death toll in the Chechen War had been about estimated about 40,000 until this week, when the National Security Advisor Alexander Lebed said that the death toll was more like 80,000. That was reported this week in your paper. I'm wondering if that seems conceivable to you, that the death toll is really twice as high as previous estimates.
Oh yeah, incredibly conceivable. I think, you know, this death toll figure, we never know what it's based on. We always say at least, I usually write as many as 40 or at least 30. 5,000 people were killed in the last year, but you never know. I mean, the Russian military put out figures saying that 1,200 of its soldiers were killed in the first year of the war. Well, I was in Grozny in the first week of January of 1995, and hundreds of Russian soldiers died in that week alone. The numbers of people killed are just, they're either lies or, it's also very difficult to know how many people died. I mean, they bombed lots of villages over the last 2 years, and a lot of people died, but I don't know that anyone knew how many people lived there in the first place, so it's not that easy to know how many people were killed. It will actually be a very difficult but important chore to document this. But no, it doesn't surprise me at all. A lot of the mothers' committees of soldiers have said more like 75,000 have died. It doesn't surprise me at all. It's a, sort of a staggering figure for the amount of time the war's been going on. But and I'm not all that experienced in other wars, but there's been a hell of a lot of damage down there.
Was the war in Chechnya a war in which journalists were respected or journalists were under fire?
I think 21 journalists were killed there in the last 2 years. I could be wrong, but if I'm wrong, I'm not off by more than one or two.
That's a really high figure.
Yeah, it was a very dangerous war. I mean, it was often difficult to know where the front was, what side people were on. I don't think that the Russian... there were groups of Chechens who were just very particularly bitter about Russian, and Russian journalists died because of it, I think.
So most of the dead journalists were Russian journalists, and they were...
Yeah, by far.
And that was probably partly a partisan thing, too, right? That they were seen as Russians, not just Russian journalists.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, there was an American photojournalist who died right at the beginning of the war. I was actually down there then. She got killed. She got hit by a bomb. There have been, I believe, German and other reporters from other places. I mean, I assume every war is very dangerous. But now the question is, did they respect us? I never was treated badly. I mean, I shouldn't say I was never treated badly, but I never felt my life was in danger by people. They point guns at you and they shoot in your direction. But no one ever made me feel like they were actually going to shoot me. And most people were very, very much respectful of what I did for a living.
Mm-hmm. What does the New York Times mean to separatists in Chechnya?
Not a damn thing, really. I think a couple of them probably know that we're a big American paper. The main thing I tried to keep them from thinking was that the New York Times, that's America, American journalists, don't they work for the CIA? I mean, these guys have sort of a vague idea about who I am and who I work for and mix us all up together. So, it wasn't actually like people ever said, oh, the New York Times, let's talk. I mean, I was just like clearly a foreign guy, and I probably worked for a big company because I have better clothes than most people do and fancy equipment, but I don't think they had any idea.
Well, Michael Spector, thank you very much for talking with us, and I hope you have a good vacation, and I look forward to reading more of your articles when you return.
Thanks a lot. It's great talking with you.
Michael Spector spoke to us from Moscow, where he is co-bureau chief for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. Coming up, a review of a new memoir about growing up in Ireland. This is Fresh Air. Frank McCourt is an inspiration to everyone who thinks they have a big book in them, but somehow can't seem to get around to writing it. For years, McCourt taught writing in a New York City high school. Now in his 60s, he's just published his first book, Angela's Ashes, a memoir of his youth in Ireland. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
It's always frustrated me that my father, whose parents came from Ireland, knows next to nothing about their early lives. They never wanted to talk much about Ireland, my dad always says. And after reading Frank McCourt's astonishing memoir, Angela's Ashes, I think I can at last understand their silence. If their Irish childhoods were anything like McCourt's, they were nothing to treasure. As he declares on the first page of his book, "Worse than the ordinary miserable childhood is the miserable Irish childhood, and worse yet is the miserable Irish Catholic childhood." You don't have to be Irish to know what he means. Just recall your James Joyce, or even that classic Irish-American weeper, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. As McCourt enumerates them, the standard elements of the saga include the shiftless, loquacious, alcoholic father, the pious, defeated mother moaning by the fire, pompous priests, and bullying schoolmasters. A writer would have to possess the pluck of a Jimmy Cagney and the dramatic gifts of a Sean O'Casey to attempt to make such rusty material shine again. Luckily, McCourt has both. Angela's Ashes deserves to be enshrined in the Library of Irish Great Books, a couple of shelves below the Book of Kells. The first chapter of McCourt's memoir closes with a reverse immigration scene. During the Depression, when McCourt is 4 years old, his parents, Malachi and Angela, decide to leave Brooklyn and seek a better life in their native Ireland, their four little sons in tow. On their first night back in Limerick, the six of them squeeze onto a bed and are promptly cannibalized by fleas living in the mattress. That incident sets the tone of the family's life over the next two decades. It's an account of poverty so dire, I sometimes lost my sense of time and thought I was reading Jonathan Swift's descriptions of 18th-century famine-starved Ireland. Malachi drinks himself out of every laboring job he finds and finally goes to work in England during the war, neglecting to send his wages home. Angela waits in dole lines, scrounges for cast-off bread and fat to feed her children, and watches helplessly as some of them die. Frank, the oldest of the brood, goes to work at 13. But the urgings of a few concerned adults to get out of Ireland ring in his ears. Putting aside pennies each week, Frank eventually saves enough for the voyage out, and the memoir ends with his jubilant return to New York. Part of what makes Angela's Ashes so extraordinary is the way McCourt slips, without coyness, into his childhood self and the density of detail he musters up. Here, for instance, is the young McCourt's description of the meal he ate when there was nothing but the wrappings from an old fish and chips supper in the house. I take the greasy newspaper from the floor. I lick the front page, which is all advertisements for films and dances in the city. I lick the war in the Pacific. I lick the obituaries and the sad memorial poems, the sports pages, the market prices of eggs, butter, and bacon. I suck the paper till there isn't a smidgen of grease. In this passage, like so many others, humiliation rubs scabby elbows with humor. Nobody recalls the past with such specificity. But McCourt writes so powerfully, I soon abandoned my skepticism and accepted Angela's Ashes as a true account, emanating from the Irish poor's collective unconscious bog of memory. The particularity of McCourt's prose precisely evokes the unhappiness of this one family and the constellation of cultural reference it finds itself enmeshed in. Much more than that, however, Angela's Ashes constructs a world we dimly recognize but cannot grasp, like the remnants of last night's dream. A wonderful, unrepeatable strangeness marks these pages, like all great literature.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Angela's Ashes by Frank McCourt. Let's end with a recent record by the great Irish singer Van Morrison, who's been described as part Celtic bard, part soul singer. This is from his album of jazz standards, How Long Has This Been Going On?
who can I turn to? When nobody needs me, my heart wants to go, so I must know where my destiny leads me. With no star to guide me, no one beside me, I will go on my way, and after the day, the darkness will hide me. Maybe, baby, maybe, 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 baby, tomorrow.
Maybe tomorrow
I'm gonna find what I'm after.
I'll find what I'm after.
Throw off my sorrow, break, steal, and borrow my share of laughter with you. I can cling to, I can learn to with you. I'm one of them new days. Who can I turn to if you turn away?
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Salat, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of The Soul's Code, In Search of Character and Calling by James Hillman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.